On this edition of Celebrating Science, Jeffrey Rosenthal on the curious world of probabilities. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation.
Good evening to everybody here in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, and to those of you who are tuning us in electronically from around the world. You're joining a Perimeter Institute public lecture. My name is John Matlock, a director with the Institute, and it's my pleasure tonight to introduce our guest speaker on the topic of the curious world of probabilities with Professor Jeffrey Rosenthal of the Department of Statistics at the University of Toronto, and just a wonderful person who I've had an opportunity to spend part of my day with today. So, if you've ever enjoyed playing a game of cards or purchased a lottery ticket or own life insurance, you're going to find his talk particularly compelling this evening. Professor Rosenthal has a very interesting background. He earned his BSc in mathematics, physics, and computer science from the University of Toronto at the age of 20, his PhD in mathematics from Harvard at the age of 24, and tenure in the Department of Statistics at the U of T at the age of 29. He is also a fellow of the Institute of Mathematical Statistics. Among his many awards, Professor Rosenthal has been honored with a Premier's Research Excellence Award, the COPS President Award, that's from the Committee of Presidents of Statistical Societies, a Harvard University Teaching Award in 1991, an Arts and Science Outstanding Teachers Award in 1998, and he is the recipient of the 2006 CRRM SSC Prize in Statistics. Dr. Rosenthal's most recent book, Struck by Lightning, The Curious World of Probabilities, deconstructs the oddities and chance in everyday life and examines the randomness that we all face as we walk through life together. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Perimeter Institute and to Waterloo, Dr. Jeffrey Rosenthal.
Thanks. Thank you so much. It's such an honor for me to be here and be part of this great and wonderful lecture series, and I thank you all for coming out. So what I'm going to talk about is about randomness and probability and uncertainty, and partially how it sort of comes up in everyday life in so many different facets, and then I'll also try to relate it to a research area of randomized algorithms or Monte Carlo algorithms. So some of it's related to my book that I wrote that was mentioned, Struck by Lightning, which is about probability in our everyday lives. And so you can think of probability and randomness. They come up whenever we're not sure what will happen next, right? So maybe you're on an airplane and you're not sure if the airplane's gonna crash. Or maybe you're waiting for the bus and you're wondering if the bus is gonna be late. Or you hear about a terrorist strike and you're wondering what the terrorists are gonna do next. Or it's election time and you hear about a poll that's accurate 19 times out of 20. Well, what does that mean, right? Or maybe you hear about a medical study that says we've proven that you should take this drug or you should do this exercise. And you say, well, can a medical study really prove something? Maybe you go to the casino, right? And you're going to gamble. And what's the probabilities that you're going to win and lose money and so on? Maybe there's a surprising coincidence. You run into somebody that you haven't seen in years. And what are the odds and so on? That's all randomness. That's all uncertainty, right? So I'll try to make the point that just a bit of an understanding of what I call the probability perspective, or how to understand probability and randomness, can go a long way towards sort of understanding things better and sometimes, deciding what to do a little bit better. And then, as I say, I'm also going to try to relate it to Monte Carlo algorithms, his sort of research area. So to start off, let me do a little warm-up example here. So here is a survey that was conducted recently, and it asked the following kind of interesting question. It said, which medium do you rely on most in order to keep abreast of the news? OK, an interesting question. And multiple choice. People could say the newspaper, they could say radio, or they could say television. They found that 62% of people responded the internet. Now, at first you think, wow, well, what does that say? It says just how important computers are in our society and how quickly things can change in a period of a few years. Well, what if I told you that the source for this survey was actually conducted on the website globeandmail.com? Well, then you'd have a different perspective, right? And so from the point of view of a probabilist, we would say, well, that was a biased sample. They were sampling people who were already getting their news off of the internet. And if anything, it's only interesting that as few as 62% of them considered that to be their primary method of getting the news. So the point of that is that even something as simple as a fact or a survey, well, there's actually randomness involved. How was the survey conducted? What can we learn from it? And so on. So I'm going to talk about a bunch of areas. Let me start off with lotteries, which was already mentioned. And somehow I find whenever people hear, oh, I study probability, it's always, oh, let's talk about the lottery. How can I win the lottery? What are the chances I'm going to win the lottery, right? So you can say, well, you know, are you going to win the big jackpot? Well, I probably don't have to tell such a sophisticated audience as yourselves that the chance you're going to win the jackpot is not very high, right? So that probably doesn't surprise you, but still people are so fascinated. And when my book came out and I was in the media, every time the lottery jackpots went up, I'd get calls and interviews from television and radio stations. Let's talk about the probabilities of the lottery. Last year there was actually this scandal with the so-called insider wins, where you might have heard about, where the retailers who were selling lottery tickets were winning a lot more of the prizes than it seemed like they should. I was actually the consulting statistician on that study. And that, to my amazement, became just huge front page news. And I was getting all these calls for interviews. So everybody's fascinated by lotteries, right? So the probability that you'll win isn't too high. But what can we say from the point of view of a probabilist? Just how unlikely is it? Well, first of all, I can give you numbers, right? So I can say if you take something like the Lotto 649, well, in order to win the jackpot, your six numbers chosen between 1 and 49 have to be the same as the six numbers that the lottery people choose. And the chance of that happening is about one chance in 14 million. There's 14 million different ways, or more precisely, 13,983,816. So that's not very likely. But a lot of people, somehow they'll hear that, and they'll say, yeah, OK, but I still think I'm going to win. Right? I think those, the odds are pretty good. So I thought some about, how can you sort of put this in perspective? How can you say just how unlikely is that? Well, so you can make various analogies. One is you can say, well, the chance that you'll win the jackpot with a single ticket, Lotto 649, is the same as the chance if you choose an adult Canadian woman at random that she will give birth to a baby within the next minute and a half. pretty unlikely, right? Or if you have to drive to the store to buy that lottery ticket, you're about twice as likely to be killed in an automobile accident going to the store as you are to win the jackpot. Or if you buy a ticket once a week, on average, you'll win the jackpot about once every 270,000 years. So just not very likely, right? Now, so from my point of view, that means, the chance you're going to win the jackpot is just so small, you just shouldn't even think about it. Now, of course, some people might enjoy or have fun playing lottery and the excitement and the dreaming, and that's fine, of course. But if you really think, oh, yeah, I think I'm going to win the lottery, well, you're just not, right? It's just so unlikely. So when I put it that way, people think, boy, I'm being a real killjoy, right? Everyone was having fun playing the lottery, and now I said it's so unlikely. But the reason I use that as an example is because not only is it very unlikely that you're going to win the lottery jackpot, but lots of other things, some of which are pretty bad, are also very unlikely. So there's sort of a flip side, and let me move on to that. So on the other hand, many bad things are also very unlikely. So let me just mention a few things. So one I'll talk briefly about is airplane crashes. And let me begin with a personal story, which is back when I was a graduate student, I was scheduled to fly to New York City to John F. Kennedy Airport to visit relatives. And exactly 1 week before my scheduled flight, there was a big plane crash at John F. Kennedy Airport in New York City. And 73 people died. And my first reaction, probably like a lot of people's first reaction, was, gosh, I can't fly to this airport now. I have to cancel my trip, or maybe I can take the train, or walk to New York City. But I'm not going to fly to New York City after this accident has taken place. And then I said, well, wait a minute. At the time, I was a graduate student studying probability theory. Maybe I can be a little bit more sensible about this. And that's really the point, is how can we be sensible about randomness and probabilities? So what did I think? Well, the first thing is, the old cliche is actually true, that airplane travel, especially commercial airplane travel, is actually very safe. And only about one commercial airplane flight in 5 million has a serious accident, an accident which involves fatalities. So in other words, if you get on a commercial airplane, you're really quite safe as far as a serious accident. If you want to worry about something, worry about being late, because about 27% of commercial flights are actually more than 15 minutes late. So that's a smart thing to worry about, right? But as far as being killed, it's really unlikely. But then you can say, well, OK, that's general fancy statistics. But this is a particular airport, right? This is John F. Kennedy Airport in New York City. Well, I looked it up, and there's actually over 5,000 flights a week just into this one airport, John F. Kennedy Airport in New York City. So what that means is even if I knew for sure that there was going to be another major accident at this airport within the next week, there would still only be about one chance in 5,000 that it would be my flight. Now, that's not so small, but it's still quite small. So that's another way to think about it. But a third way to think about it is to say, well, you know, this crash, it wasn't the fault of the airport, it seemed. So in other words, the airport wasn't to blame. So whether my flight was going to crash was actually what we call statistically independent of whether this other flight crashed. And we can't really, you know, just because that flight crashed didn't make it any more or less likely that my flight would crash. And when you think of it that way, it's a little bit like that old joke about the guy who was worried that somebody might bring a bomb onto his airplane. So his solution was to always bring his own bomb onto the airplane. Because he figured the chance of two different bombs on the same airplane was just astronomically unlikely, so he was safe. So now, of course, in that case, whether he had a bomb and whether the bad guy had a bomb were independent, right? Neither one had any effect on the other. And the same with me in this other flight. So for all those reasons, I said, wait a minute, I'm being silly. It's OK to fly to New York City. And I did, and everything was fine. I used this example when I was being interviewed on the radio once. And the radio announcer said, oh, yeah, well, you know, that's great. You've got all these, you know, fancy statistics, right? But does that really help when, you know, you're up in the sky and there's a little turbulence and you get nervous and so on? And it's a fair question. And my answer is yes, it does help if you really stop and think about how unlikely these things are. So if it's just in one here and out the other, it's not going to help. But if you really stop and think about it, you realize that just like I'm not going to win the lottery, the airplane's not going to crash. So you realize these things are so unlikely that it really can't affect things. And in my case, I actually used to be kind of a nervous traveler, right? Whenever there was a little turbulence, I'd be looking out the window to see if the wing was still attached properly and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And now I'm actually not. I say, no, it's extremely unlikely there's going to be a problem. So, okay, so then you say, well, that's airplane crashes. Let me mention a few other things. One is, let me mention briefly the terrorism issue. So that's something that comes up a lot. And of course, it's a very serious issue that people think about. And in particular, after, let's say, the 9/11 terrorist attacks, well, you know, it had a huge effect on people's psyches, right? I say, you know, sales of anxiety medications went way up, and people were very fearful. And a number of couples, including one that I know personally, they decided they better get married now while they could, right? So there was a real feeling that, you know, everything had really changed and so on. So what can we say about that from a probability point of view? Well, obviously, you know, the 9/11 attacks were a horrendous event by any stretch of the imagination, and that's for sure. But then we can say, well, as far as how does it affect our lives? Well, here's one thing that kind of puts it in perspective, at least for me, a sort of a perspective, and that's that in the month of September 2001, the month of the 9/11 attacks, more Americans were killed that month in ordinary automobile accidents than were killed in the 9/11 attacks. Now, what does that mean? I mean, it certainly doesn't mean anything from a moral point of view. We can't equate these things at all. But if we think from the point of view of, you know, I'm a random person in North America, what's the chance that I'm going to be killed? Well, the probabilities didn't change that much because of 9/11, right? It was just something that was comparable. It was less than 1 month of automobile accidents. Now, again, it's not to in any way minimize it, but it is to say that, you know, this whole anxiety medication and we've got to get married now and so on maybe wasn't in keeping with the real probability. So it's just one perspective, and I know there's a lot one can think about when it comes to such atrocities, let's say. But one perspective is, you know, how does it affect the probabilities that I'm going to be killed? The answer is not nearly as much as you would think from reading the headline. So that's a way to think about that. Speaking of big, bad headlines, I want to talk a little bit about homicides. Well, maybe more than a little bit. I'll use this as an example. So certainly, if you live in Toronto, which I realize we're not in now, then boy, are there headlines when the homicide rate goes up. And in particular, back in 2005, which is just when I was finishing this book and I was sort of more involved in the public eye kind of things, it so happened that the number of homicides in Toronto went up in 2005. And there were a total of 78 homicides in the city of Toronto in the year 2005. compared to 64 the previous year, which was a 22% increase. So I was living in Toronto, and here's an example of the kind of headlines that went along with that. So the media said that the guns are being used to bathe Toronto in blood, that Toronto has lost its innocence. 2005 is the summer of the gun. And our police chief chimed in saying the situation was that gun-crazed gangsters terrorize at will. So pretty serious stuff, right? So you can say, well, was this media hype justified, right? Well, again, I mean, from the sort of moral point of view, of course, every homicide is a great tragedy and every loss of life is very serious. Then you say, well, what are the numbers really telling us? You know, is it really that things have changed and things are all out of control? Well, what? So first of all, okay, I mean, there was a 22% increase from 2004 to 2005, and that's something that's, you know, worth looking at. On the other hand, it was still not as high homicide rate as Toronto had had back in the 80s and early 90s. Also, as a way of perspective, it so happens that Toronto is much safer than a lot of other cities. So you probably won't be surprised to hear that it's a lot safer than a lot of American cities. So its homicide rate is, the homicide rate for New York City, let's say, is over 3 times as high. The homicide rate for Buffalo is about 10 times as high. The homicide rate for Detroit is about 20 times as high. That's the rate per person, right? So comparing the same rates. So you probably won't be surprised at that. What you might be surprised at is that Toronto is even pretty safe by Canadian standards. And in fact, Edmonton and Regina and Winnipeg all have homicide rates per capita, which are about twice as big as that of Toronto. Now, you know, again, it doesn't necessarily mean so much, but it does seem sort of counter to these headlines that we see. And in particular, if you're thinking, what's the chance that I, as a random person in Toronto, am going to be, you know, the victim of a homicide? Well, first of all, it's, you know, much less than a lot of other cities, and it's certainly much less than, say, the chance of being hit by a car, that kind of thing. Also, another interesting statistic is that in Canada, more people are murdered by their own spouse than are murdered by a stranger. So what that means is instead of worrying about who's lurking behind that lamppost in the park, right, maybe you should be thinking about who you choose to marry, right? And of course, the real lesson is not that we should all worry that our spouse is going to kill us, but that we shouldn't spend all our time worrying that we're going to be the victim of a random shooting the way that people in Toronto were. So that sort of puts a little bit of a perspective on it. I want to say just a little bit more about Toronto homicides before I move on. So if that goes on, oops. Uh-oh, that doesn't look very good. Okay, there we go. So this is a graph which actually shows the number of homicides in Toronto year by year from 1991 to 2007. And, you know, these circles represent the numbers. So we can see it was actually higher than any time since back in 1991. Then it was steady at about 60, sometimes a little less, and so on. And then this circle here, that's the 2005 circle. That's when things went up by 22%. Now, at the time, what I suspected would happen is that in 2006, things would probably return to their more typical rates, which is indeed what happened if you see the 2006 circle here. And furthermore, I predicted accurately that there would be virtually no headlines about that. And that, you know, nobody said Toronto has regained its innocence in 2006, right? So you say, okay, so at this point I thought I had it figured out, right? That, you know, the media and the police and the politicians, they like to hype when there's, you know, crime increases, they really want to hype that. When crime goes down, they're really not going to say very much about it. I thought I had it all figured out. And then this last year, something else happened. The crime rate, if you look at this last circle, that's for 2007, actually went up again. So, and to my mind, statistically speaking, looking at things, and this line here is sort of a line of best fit, and it now has the tiniest bit of an increase, and I think with the 2007 numbers, we can now say, okay, maybe after years of declining, the Toronto homicide and crime rates, maybe they're starting to just inch back up a little bit. I'd be willing to accept that in a headline. So I would have assumed that there'd be huge headlines in Toronto this year or last year too. And actually, there weren't that many headlines last year either. And so now my theory is that everyone got so worn out hyping things up back in 2005 that they didn't have energy left for headlines in 2007. But I think the real lesson of all that is that somehow the media headlines are just not that related to what's really happening, right? And if you just look at the numbers, you can see what's really happening a lot more. So I would say that Toronto, you know, crime's been slowly and steadily actually decreasing a bit, pretty steady, maybe inching up a little bit now. So Anyway, so that's my perspective on that. And then before leaving homicides, let me say, I know there's a stereotype that the people from Toronto, you know, they come to some other city, but all they know about and all they care about is the city of Toronto, right? Now, that stereotype's actually pretty accurate, but I thought to try to overcome it, I would say, well, what can we say about Waterloo or about the Kitchener? So this is the Kitchener-Waterloo census metropolitan area, which includes the city of Waterloo, as you'll know. So here's actually a graph of the number of homicides year by year for the same, well, this is actually going back from the 80s to 2005. And one thing we can see is that the numbers actually jump around a fair bit. And, well, why is that? Well, that's because, well, to be frank, you people don't really kill each other enough, right? Or more accurately, because it's a smaller region, that the numbers are smaller, and therefore, on a relative scale, there's more variability. So that's why you can have as few as, you know, 3 1 year and 9 the next, and then 4 and so on, because the numbers are relatively small. And if you look at a trend, in case you were worried, actually, if you look at the trend lines for the Kitchener CMA, they're actually slightly decreasing. So not only are there a small number of homicides in Kitchener-Waterloo area, but actually the rate, if you look at the line of best fit, despite all this randomness, is actually slightly decreasing too. But then you say, well, how can we compare this to the Toronto numbers? Of course, we can't just compare the numbers because the populations are so different. So the right way to compare all these statistics is on a per capita basis, or the rates per 100,000 as they're usually reported. So here I have just one last thing about homicides, which is comparing some different, these are the homicide rates per 100,000 people. And this is for four different things. This is for Edmonton up here, and then for all of Canada in the red here, and then Toronto in the blue, and then the Kitchener CMA in green. And, well, what can we learn from a graph like this? Well, first of all, we can see that things tend to jump around a lot from year to year. Second of all, we can see, and this is going back all the way to 1980 or 1981, in general, things stay pretty much the same, or if anything, there's a slight downward trend overall. But furthermore, if we think about ordering them, we can say, well, Edmonton, you know, is way up here at the top, and on a per capita basis, is actually much less safe than Toronto, despite what some may think. Canada is right about in the middle. Toronto is actually marginally safer than Canada as a whole. So you're actually marginally less likely to be killed by a random homicide in Toronto than in Canada as a whole. And then Kitchener-Waterloo jumps all around. On the whole, it's a little bit less than Toronto, but not that much less, right? If we put everything on the same scale, it's not that different. And just for context, you know, if we wanted to put in New York, it'd be up at the top of the screen. And if we wanted to put in Buffalo, it'd be on the ceiling. And if we wanted to put in Detroit, we'd have to do some major renovations to the building, right? So you know, it just gives you a bit of a perspective on things. So, okay, and let me just say, sort of to wrap up the sort of bad things are unlikely theme, that, you know, there's a lot of other things that make the headlines. Like if a child gets abducted, you know, that's going to be in the headlines for months. And of course, it's a serious story. But the reason it's in the headlines is because, not because it happens so much, but because it's actually so rare. And, you know, by contrast, over a third of Canadians will eventually die from cardiovascular disease. So that's something that actually kills a lot of people. Not very often you see a headline that says, man dies of heart attack, right? And it's because it's actually, unfortunately, it's such a common thing. So in other words, we get this headline in the bias of how common or uncommon things are. And in fact, another way to think about it is, you know, cardiovascular disease is a very serious killer. And one of the risk factors associated with cardiovascular disease is stress and worry. So it's actually possible. I don't really know how to prove it, but it seems possible to me that more people die from worrying about terrorists and homicides and so on than are actually killed by terrorists and homicides. So, and and again, it's not to equate them on any kind of a moral level, right? Because you have to keep distinct the, you know, the compassion and the morality from the facts and numbers. But from the facts and numbers point of view, these things are actually all very unlikely. So anyway, so I want to talk about things that are a little more cheery. So let me move on to casinos. So, you know, probably most of you at one time or another have been to the casino or at least have done some gambling. And from a probability point of view, casinos are kind of interesting because they talk about how probabilities work, and in particular how they work in the long run, which is going to be related to the research theme that I move into. So let me just start off, let's say, you know, it's often controversial when a new casino is built, right? People think it'll lead to gambling addiction, or it'll lead to bad habits, or it'll ruin the neighborhood, or it'll lead to more crime, or all sorts of things. But nobody ever says, I don't think we should build this casino because I don't think it's going to make any money. So now, if you think about it, that's kind of a puzzling situation, right? Because any person who goes to the casino, they might win money, they might lose money, so the casino might make a profit or might have a loss. how can we be so sure that the casinos are going to win money in the long run? And to be specific, let me talk about the casino game called Craps. So probably you're familiar with this game where you repeatedly roll two ordinary six-sided dice. And the first time, if you get a 7 or an 11, then you win. If you get a 2 or a 3 or a 12, then you lose. If you get some other number, like let's say a 4, then that becomes your point. And then you keep on rolling until you either get another 4, then you win, or until you get a 7, then you lose, right? So kind of complicated rules. And you might say the first thing, well, how did this game develop with such complicated, strange rules? Well, the reason is actually from the probabilities. The probability of winning if you play craps works out, if you work out all the different possibilities, to 49.29%, which, as the astute among you will note, is slightly less than 50%, right? So you say, okay, that's interesting. And this is actually common to most casino games, that they're, you know, pretty much a 50-50 game, but just weighted slightly in favor of the house. So what does that mean? Well, it means if you play craps once, even if you bet a lot of money, you have just about the same chance of winning as losing. Well, that sounds pretty good, right? But then what's interesting from a probability point of view is sort of what happens in the long run. And so I'm going to try now, with some trepidation, to run an interactive simulation. So here we go. This is my interactive simulation. And what is this here? This is a probabilist view of what it's like to gamble in a casino, right? So what is this here? So the idea is you're going to go to the casino, you're going to bet $10 at the game of craps. So, and this black dot's going to keep track of how much money you have. You start with $100, and well, let's do the first bet. So I'm going to do it, and the computer's going to do this randomly. The first time you bet, you're either going to go up to $110 if you win, or you're going to go down to $90 if you lose, and randomly, let's see what happens. Oh, congratulations, you all won $10, right? So you're up to $110. But then what I want to say is what happens after that? So let's say we do it again. You're going to gamble again from 110. Oh, you lost that time. You're back to $100. Let me get that running. So it's going to randomly choose, oh, you lost again. You're down to $90. You won. You're back up to $100, and so on. And the question I want to ask now is not the chance of your winning each individual bet, but what happens in the long run? And in particular, suppose you start with $100 as you did. What's the chance that you will get up to $200 here first before you lose all your money and get down to $0 here? So probabilists call that aptly the gambler's rune problem, right? So the question is, what's the chance you're going to be ruined? Oh, you're not doing too good. You're down to 40. You're down to 30. Not looking good, right? Okay, you're back up to 40. You haven't lost yet, right? So we're sort of thinking, what happens in the long run? And in particular, what are the odds? So you're doing a little better now. You're back up to 60. What's the probability that you will make it up to 200 before you lose all your money? Well, since I only have an hour, I'm going to speed this up a little bit. And now I should say you've already made 20 bets in this simulation, but let me go a little faster. Now you've made, 25 bets, up to 80, 70, made 30 bets. So the first thing you can see, you can take a while, right? You can win and lose and so on, and this happens at real casinos. You win some money and you lose some money and so on. And, you know, it's kind of exciting and nobody knows what's going to happen. Let's see, I'm going to go faster. And again, this is being simulated by the computer. I don't know what's going to happen. Uh-oh. Okay, you're hanging in there. Okay, I'm going to go faster now. So we're up to 60 bets, 70 bets, 75, 80 bets, 90 bets. You're hanging in there, right? 100 bets. He's counting the bets there. 110 bets, 120 bets. You're all very feisty here in Waterloo. I see that. Up to 150 bets. You're still hanging in there, right? So, man, I do have faster speeds if I need them, right? So I might have to speed up again. This is taking more. On average, it will take about 99 bets for this simulation to end. So far, you're up to 240 bets. And again, it's kind of random, but you're not doing too good. You're still hanging in there, though. Okay. Oh, you're pulling up. Man, we could be here all day. I might have to speed it up again, although I didn't think I would. We're up to 350 bets. Oh, there you go. Okay. So after 360 $10 bets, you lost, right? You lost your $100. So then you say, okay, well, that's interesting, but maybe if we played again, maybe you'd win. Now, I'm not going to do this one again, but on the other hand, I can tell you a fact. It's not too hard to work out, although it's not too easy, actually, but you can work out that the chance that you'll win, the chance starting with $100 that you'll get up to $200 before you lose all your money, is equal to about 43%. I'm getting ahead of myself. So in other words, it's almost 50-50. Even this thing, even though it takes a while, You get down to about 43%. Instead of the 49.29% you had of winning one bet, it's about a 43% chance that if you keep betting $10, that you'll actually get up to $200 before you lose all your money. That's not so bad either, right? It's pretty close to fair. But what happens if you have even more money? So let's do the case here now where you start with $1,000, so there's 1,000 here, and we're now asking, what's the chance you're gonna get up to $2,000 first before you lose all your money and get down to zero? Well, the first thing we can say is, you know, if you thought that first simulation took a while, right? This one, we're still here, what are we at, about $1,020 or something, and we're doing all these bets. So this one I am gonna do warp speed here. So let me go, that's doing faster, that's doing 100 up to 200 bets, 250 bets, still taking a while, right? So I'm gonna go even faster. You can see it's counting the number of bets, up to 1,500, 2,000, 3,000 bets, 4,000 bets, 5,000 bets, 6,000 bets, 7,000 bets. You're still being very feisty, right? These are thousands of bets, and you're making way, but oh, you eventually lost, okay? So in this case, it took how many? It took 10,672 bets, but you finally lost all your money. And in this case, the chance that starting with $1,000 that you would manage to double your money before you lost it all, is this is about 5.5%, I misspoke before, which is about one chance in 18. So in other words, it's still not impossible, right? And sometimes you can run the simulation and you can win. But on the other hand, you're usually going to win. And as you might guess, this pattern continues. So if you started with 5,000, well, let me do one more. I hate to see it end. So if we start with $5,000, and we're saying, what's the chance we get up to $10,000, again, making the $10 bets each time before we lose all our money? Well, this one, we really have to go faster because we're already up to 12,000 bets. So let me go super duper fast. We're up to 25,000 bets. Okay, after 32,000 and something bets, we lost all our money. Well, that one didn't surprise me because in this case, starting with $5,000, the chance you'll double your money before you lose it all is about one chance in 1.4 million. So it's just not gonna happen, right? Or if you started with $10,000, the chance you'd double your money before you lost it all, betting $10 each time, is one chance in 10 million billion. Just astronomical odds. So this is why casinos make money, right? And let me return to the slides here. Oops. So why do casinos make money? Well, this is something that we actually call the law of large numbers, that some of you may have heard of or be familiar with. And it's this law that says, okay, if the odds are slightly against you, like they are at craps, in any one bet, you might win or you might lose. Even in a few bets, you might win or you might lose. But as you make hundreds and thousands of bets, thousands and ten thousands of bets, over the long run, you're more and more certain to lose because things get closer and closer to their true probability. So the fraction of times you win gets closer and closer to being 49.29% of the time, which is to say it becomes more and more certain that you've won less times than you've lost. So in the long run, you're gonna lose money if you gamble a lot. If you gamble a little bit, you might make money. But from the casino's point of view, if you put everybody together, they're gambling lots and lots and lots, and for sure, the casino's gonna make money. So this law of large numbers, to my mind, is not just interesting for gambling, but it's actually interesting for a lot of things in life. So I sometimes think of it as sort of a probabilist form of karma. What's a probabilist form of karma? Well, it's this idea, as I say, that things will, over the long run, get close to their true probability. So if someone succeeds at something once, maybe they just got lucky. But if they succeed most of the time over the long run, they probably have some talent, right? That's the principle. So it comes up all kinds of ways. Like, for example, I like to think of myself as a pretty rational person, except when I drive in the city of Toronto. And then I can get a little frustrated. And in particular, there's this one traffic light near my house that I swear every time I pull up to it, it's always red. And I tell my wife, I see this light, it's always red. And she turns to me, she says, honey, haven't you read your own book? Don't you know? Because of course she knows that if it's a light that's red half the time and green half the time, over the long run, it's gonna be green green about as often as it's red, or about half the time. And you know, I only notice it when it's red because of this sort of observational bias, right? That I notice it when it's red. But the reality is over the long run, it's gonna settle down to its true probabilities. And this comes up all kinds of ways. Like if we think of a game, you know, if you play someone a game once, you might win by luck. Over the long run, the better player is gonna win more. And frankly, that's why the Stanley Cup playoffs are a series of seven instead of being a single game, right? A single game, well, the worst team still might have a pretty good chance of winning. Over the long run, it's gonna be more and more likely that the better team is gonna win. Some say it should really be a lot more than 7 games to get a more accurate sense of things, right? But it comes up, for example, you know, say you're investing in stocks or you're trying to judge whether an investor is a good or a bad investor. Well, if they picked one stock that did well, they could have gotten lucky. But if over many stocks in many years they're always beating the market, well, then they probably know what they're talking about. So same kind of thing, the sort of law of large numbers. So this story is a true story. Back when I was 25 years old, which is longer and longer ago with every passing year, but I was a fairly healthy young man, and then I went for a routine checkup, and they did all kinds of tests on me at a doctor's office. And a few days later, I got a letter in the mail. And the letter said, oh, the test for lupus indicates that you may have it. Now, if you're a young, healthy 25-year-old, and you're suddenly told, you know, you might have lupus, that's actually quite a devastating thing to hear. And the letter said, well, about 5% of the normal population will still test positive for this test. It wasn't a perfect test. So you should come into the doctor's office to do another test or whatever. So, you know, I went to the doctor's office, and he said they could do a DNA test, but it would take a couple of weeks to come back from the lab. So for a couple of weeks, I had to live with the situation that, you know, this test had come back, and I might have lupus. And at the time, I was a young professor of probability, and I was going kind of crazy, and I said, well, how can I use probability to try to help me understand the situation better? And, you know, if you think about it a little bit, you can say, okay, well, they said that, 5% of the normal population will test positive for this disease. At first, that doesn't sound too good, right? It sounds like only 5%. It sounds like there's a 95% chance that I have this disease. But then you say, well, how can I think about this a little more sensibly? Well, I looked it up, and a little bit less than 1% of the population will ever develop a lupus. So then you say, okay, so let's think about this. I didn't have any particular symptoms of lupus, so there was no particular evidence that I had it. So what does that mean? If I test positive on this test, I could be part of the 5% who will get a false positive on this test, or I could be part of the 1% who actually has lupus. So what that means is out of the 6% chance that I would have tested positive for this test, only 1 out of that 6 is actually having lupus. So what we call the conditional probability that I had lupus, given that I tested positive on this test, which is only wrong 5% of the time, was still only about 1 chance in 6, or about 17%. Now, that's still a little higher than I might have wanted the probability to be, right? But on the other hand, it was a lot better than the 95% that was sort of the first impression I got. So it was enough to sort of calm me down while waiting for the test. And then finally, the test came back, and I did not have lupus. So what's the point of that? The point is we can interpret conditional events based on this sort of conditional probability. It's not very hard. It doesn't require a lot of math or anything. But it just requires thinking about what are the different ways that this observation could have happened. And so out of that, what could the chances be? In this case, this 1 in 6 chance. So when I've told people the story, some people say, well, how come that letter from the doctor, you know, that letter that said, oh, 5% of the normal population will test positive, why didn't it say, so therefore you have 1 chance in 6 of having lupus? Well, that's a pretty good question, right? And you know, the way I see it, well, first of all, I think we can probably agree that the medical profession is not particularly well oriented towards alleviating anxiety. So probably that wasn't the first thing on their mind when they wrote the letter. But then the other thing is, who knows if the doctor could have worked out that conditional probability, right? Because even though it's quite simple, it's not the way a lot of people think. So the point is, if you just understand a bit of probability or how to think about it, you can work things out that a lot of people don't work out. So that's one thing to think about. But let me talk about, so this idea of usefulness of randomness. Well, there's times when we actually need to generate randomness. So one of them is, we sort of already mentioned surveys and polls. So for example, with that, the GlobeandMail.com survey that we mentioned at the beginning, the problem with it was they didn't generate a random sample of Canadians or whatever when they were doing their poll. They just got the people who happened to log into GlobeandMail.com, happened to click on the survey question. So, and if you're doing a real survey, whether it's for like a marketing survey or an opinion poll for an election, everything else about polling is really easy. The hard part is getting a random sample of people to give their answers. And all kinds of obstacles come up. For example, some people will refuse to answer when the pollsters call them. A lot of people will. In fact, it's only something like 1 person in 3 who's actually willing to talk to the pollsters. So pollsters are always trying to compensate for or try to understand that and so on. Also, for example, if somebody has a cell phone only, well, the pollsters aren't allowed to call cell phones because the cell phone person might have to pay for the call. So if you only have a cell phone, you're just not part of the population being sampled. And pollsters are trying to figure out how that's changing things. So getting a random sample is very important, but also very hard when you're doing polling. Medical testing's another thing, or medical studies. So, you know, if studies are going to prove something, well, there's some statistical issues, but again, one very important thing is you better assign the treatments randomly. You better not give the magic new pill to everyone who is about to get better anyway and give the old pill to everyone who is about to die, right? So these things have to be done by double-blind studies and so on. And again, it's a case where we need to generate the randomness. We need to use randomness. Computer games. So probably you've all played a computer game at some time or another. Well, there's probably, you know, there's the other team, or there's the bad guys, or the spaceships, or whatever. And you don't want them to move exactly the same way every time you play the game. They all work from randomness, or from pseudo-randomness, which is the computer trying to make things random, because that's when it gets interesting. Just like with our simulation, the computer was generating randomness. So there's this idea of generating randomness, or using randomness, is very useful. Here's one that someone just told me recently. Oops, I was complaining with a fellow colleague about the issue of students cheating on tests and exams at the University of Toronto. I'm sure that's not a problem here in Waterloo, but in, you know, Toronto, that can be an issue. And, you know, so sometimes you say, oh, well, those two people, you know, they seem like they're friends, and they seem like they're kind of the people who might cheat, so at the exam I'm going to try to force them to sit far apart. My colleague said, oh, that's nothing. What I do is I just generate the seating assignment randomly. And then in a large class, the probability that those two people who wanted to cheat are going to happen to end up next to each other is extremely small. So it's a novel case of using randomness for something useful. Let me mention one more before I get into the research thing. And that's this idea of random strategies. And so I'll set it up by that old classic game, Rock, Paper, Scissors. So probably we've all played that game. You know, you do 1, 2, 3, shoot, and if you get a rock, then you smash the scissors, or if you get a scissors, you can cut the paper. If you get a paper, you can cover the rock, right? So it's this game that's sometimes used by children to decide who goes first in a sport or something. What I didn't actually know until a couple years ago, although maybe you do, is that some people take rock, paper, scissors extremely seriously. And there are world championships of rock, paper, scissors held every year with a $5,000 prize for first place. No, I am not making this up. And you know, in this game, obviously, they don't just do rock, paper, scissors once. They do it repeatedly, this back and forth kind of thing. And, for example, the 2005 champ was quoted in the papers as explaining how he won. He said, quote, "My personal strategy was to read the minds of my competitors and figure out what they were thinking." So and you start thinking about it, and you think, well, you know, is there really any skill in a game like rock, paper, scissors? Well, if you just do it once, it seems like there really isn't much skill, although even then it's a little hard to say. But if you do it over and over again, it's at least conceivable that you will start to pick up on patterns of your opponent, right? Maybe your opponent, you know, after rock, they always do scissors the next time, or after they win, they always do the same thing the next time, or some sort of pattern. And if you can detect any kind of pattern, even if it's not for sure, but just occasionally true, that's going to be enough to give you that little bit of edge, just like the house had a bit of an edge in craps, right? So if you can get that little bit of an edge, maybe you win. So this guy who won in 2005, maybe he just got lucky, but maybe he did have an edge. So anyway, so this, I was reading about this and thinking about game theory, or about the theory of sort of strategies in competitive situations. And I thought, you know, what would I do if I was in a rock, paper, scissors competition, right? Well, the answer is, even though we laugh about it now, I'd probably be pretty nervous, right? Because I'd be up against these people who thought they could read my mind, and you're quickly shooting all these things. Well, one thing I could do if I was up against a champ is I could say, I'm going to use a random strategy. So I'm going to take, let's say, like a six-sided die. I'm going to secretly roll it. If it comes up one or two, I'll say rock. If it comes up three or four, I'll say scissors. If it comes up five or six, I'll say a paper. Well, what's the point of that? Well, the point of that is that if I do that, and as long as the other guy can't see the die, right, that's pretty important, but if he can't see the die, then no matter how experienced he is at rock, paper, scissors, no matter what strategy he uses, no matter what data he has on my past practices and so on, he can do no better than have a 50% chance of beating me at rock, paper, scissors. So in other words, I could be just as good as the champion, or at least I could tie the champion in the long run using this strategy. So what's the point of that? The point is, this is related to game theory, as I say, this sort of science of, in competitive situations, whether it's an actual game, or whether it's, you know, international relations, or war, or whether it's like a business competitive issue. There's always the issue of, you know, what's the other guy going to do, and what am I going to do, and if he does this, I'll do that, and so on. And it turns out that you can achieve what's sometimes called a Nash equilibrium. And there's a whole theory, I won't get into it, but you can achieve sort of, you know, strategies so that the other guy can't take more advantage of you, roughly speaking. And they're named after John Nash, who was that eccentric genius from the movie A Beautiful Mind, right? And there's this idea that you can achieve them, at least in a finite game, with a finite number of chances, a finite number of options, but only if you can use randomness. So like in that rock, paper, scissors, if you can use that die and roll it and get randomness, then you can tie the champion. But if you don't, then you can't. So anyway, that's all I'll say about that, but this idea of, you know, random strategy, so uses of randomness. And I want to try to put this all together and talk a little bit about some Monte Carlo computer algorithms. So this is something that might sound a little obscure, but actually it's my main line of research. And in fact, it's the line of research for tens of thousands of people around the world. It's used a tremendous amount in, you know, studies of physics and chemistry and statistical models and computer science issues and so on. You'll get hundreds of thousands of hits in Google if you search for it, so it must be important, right? So what is this Monte Carlo computer algorithm? Well, so to set it up, let's say that it's usually applied when you have a really complicated model. So for example, in statistical models, say you're doing medical testing, and maybe you've got, you know, some new drug, and you say maybe this lowers blood pressure, or maybe it doesn't. But then you say, well, you know, it might depend on a bunch of other factors. You know, maybe it depends on the patient's age and their weight and their family history and their medical conditions and whether they're a smoker and how much alcohol they consume. And maybe it depends on unknown factors like their underlying heart health and their, you know, the size of their arteries and all kinds of things. So you can imagine making a pretty complicated model with lots of different variables, and maybe some of them are known and some of them aren't. And then you'd probably have a study with a bunch of patients, and you might have hundreds or even thousands of patients of which you're giving the drug or not giving the drug and measuring outcomes like blood pressure. And then you try to put it all together and draw some conclusions. So that's what statisticians do, pretty much. And you say, okay, we've got all this data for different people. We've got their different, you know, their age and blood pressure and yada yada, and we've got their smoking history and so on. We've got all these patients. Now we'd like to draw conclusions about the effect of this drug. The models get pretty complicated. So in a case like that, one issue is, how are we going to do a statistical model that really takes into account all the factors? But then another issue, which is the computational issue that I want to focus on, is even if we've got this big complicated model and we've got all this data, how do we actually compute with it? How do we actually figure out what this model says? And you might think, well, we just put it on a computer, and, you know, computers are fast. The answer is yes, computers are fast, but computers are not fast enough. So if you've got enough variables, then that's what we call a high-dimensional problem. And even computers working full out, the fastest modern computers, just aren't fast enough to even come close to actually computing all these variables. So Monte Carlo algorithms are a way to try to compute when things get big and complicated. So I'd like to make an analogy. So this analogy will say, suppose you're climbing in a beautiful mountain range, and your friend says to you, say, I wonder what the average altitude in this mountain range is. You might say, you know, who cares, just enjoy the view, right? But but suppose you didn't. You said, yeah, I wonder what the average. So in some places, the mountains get really high, and in some places, the valleys get really low, and there's plateaus, and there's medium-sized mountains and so on. And suppose you had something like a barometer so you could measure the altitude at any one particular point. You said, okay, here's the altitude here, here's the altitude here. But then you look out and you see it's a huge mountain range with all these mountains and peaks and so on. And you say, how am I going to get an average here? I can measure the value at any one place, but how can I average it? Well, one thing you could do is a Monte Carlo algorithm. So let me try to set it up. So what you would do is you would say, I'm just going to explore at random. Now you might say, why at random? Why not just be systematic and say, I'll, you know, take a measurement and move 1 meter and take another measurement and move another meter and so on? And the answer is, it's just too big, right? You don't have enough research assistants. They can't cover this whole mountain range for you. So what you say is, well, I'm just going to walk around at random. I'm not going to try to cover every single inch or every single square meter or even square kilometer maybe of this mountain range. I'm just going to wander around for a while. And then I'm going to stop. I'm going to take a measurement. I'm going to write it down in my notebook. And I'm going to wander around for a while. And then I'm going to stop. I'm going to take another measurement, write it down in my notebook. And you can think of that as kind of like you're conducting a poll, like in opinion polls, where they don't ask every single Canadian who you're going to vote for. They ask a random sample. And it's the same kind of thing. You say we're doing a random sample of the mountain range. And we're saying, OK, and we're getting in our notebook. We're getting all these different numbers. And then we could just average up those numbers. So we'll get different altitudes at different places. Take the average of that. Now, it's not quite the same as if we really truly averaged up everything in this mountain range, but it's sort of this random poll of everything we could do. And this version we might call a Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm. So the Monte Carlo, of course, comes from the famous casino in Monaco, and it comes from this idea of using randomness, right? So they call it Monte Carlo. And then Markov chain is just a particular kind of randomness where what you do next kind of depends on what you just did the previous time. So somehow where you wander next depends on where you started from. But anyway, let's not worry about that. Let's just see if we can do a little simulation here. So I'm going to do another simulation of a simplified version of Markov chain Monte Carlo. So what do we have here? We have another little, another simple graph here. Now what we have here, these are blue bars which represent the probabilities that we want to sample. So if you're in the mountain range analogy, you could think this represents how much time we want to spend at the different valleys and peaks and mountains and peaks of the mountain range. If you're in the statistical sampling context, then you can think, well, this represents the probabilities for, you know, the chance that the drug is going to help the guy lower his blood pressure if he smoked and if he was alcoholic and if this and if that. So it would generally be a big complicated thing. So just think of these blue bars as some big complicated thing that we would like to be able to compute. But we can't because it's too big. We don't have enough time. The computers aren't fast enough. And then this black dot here, this represents our guy on the mountain range who's wandering around with a notebook and averaging things up. So there's particular rules for how this Markov chain works, and I'm not going to give them all in detail, but I'll say that this guy, so this is a simplified case where there's only 6 points instead of a big, huge, high-dimensional thing, but this guy, he starts at this point 5. Each time, he can move either to the left or to the right, and it's sort of a two-step process. This is something called the Metropolis algorithm, and I won't give the details, but the first step is he chooses randomly whether he's going to try to move to the left or try to move to the right. So in this case, he said, okay, I'm going to try to move to the left. So he said, I'm at 5, I'm going to try to move to 4. Then he decides whether or not to move, and this is either going to turn green or red. Depending, in this case, it turned green. I mean, he said, yeah, I think it's a good idea to move to 4. That whether he decides has to do with the ratio of the height of that blue bar to the height of that blue bar, because he's trying to sample with the right probabilities. But don't worry too much about that. So he's going to decide, okay, I'm going to move to 4. And then he's going to start again. Let me get this going. He's going to go either left or right. Oh, I'm going to try to go right. Oh, it's a red dot. Means he doesn't move. He stays at 4. Now, okay, he's going to try to move to the right. This time he accepted, and he's going to the right. Again, the computer's doing this randomly. There's no preset pattern. And let me add one more thing here, which are these black bars. And these black bars simply represent what fraction of the time the black dot has spent at each point so far. So in this case, it spent quite a bit of time at 4. That's why we got a big bar. A bit of time at 5 and no time at 6 or 1 or 2 or 3. Oh, there, it finally moved to 6 for the first time, so we got a bit of a black bar at 6. Well, what's the point of all that? The point is, and let me get this going a little faster, over time it's going to move around by these random rules of whether to go left or go right and accept or reject, and these black bars are going to update by the fraction of time that it spent at each one of these dots. And why do I care about this? Well, let me make it go faster. So as we go zipping around, over time, so far it's sort of stuck at 4, 5, and 6. Over time, it will eventually make it to 1, 2, and 3 as well. And since time's running a little short, I'm going to go to warp speed again here. But so let's say as it goes to warp speed, it's still doing the same algorithm, just faster. We've done 180 iterations now. Over time, these black bars, which are keeping track of the fraction of time it's spent everywhere, well, you can actually see it happening now. They're getting closer and closer to the blue bars, right? So I realize you might not find that quite as exciting as I do, right? Because this is my life we're talking about here, right? But what's the point here? So why do we care that the black bars get closer and closer to the blue bars? Well, remember what they represented. The blue bars represented this big, unknown, complicated, high-dimensional thing with, you know, a statistical model or a mountain range and something that we could never compute. The black bars represented our guy with a notebook. And we can keep track of everything in the notebook. So the point is, we're using this guy in the notebook, these random steps that move around, to give us a good approximation to this big, huge, unknown thing of the blue bars. So the fact that these black bars converge to the blue bars is why there is tens of thousands of people working on Monte Carlo algorithms and using them to compute things, because it replaces big, complicated unknowns with things that you can keep track of as you go. And of course, it wouldn't be a notebook. It would be a computer program. But the computer program would be keeping track of where it goes randomly. So it's a way to sort of beat the fact that things are too complicated to compute by allowing us to compute them anyway using randomness. So the point of that is that, you know, we use randomness, and that helps us to compute things. Let's see.
guess I'm a little short of time, so maybe I will skip the last. I'm going to talk something about coincidences. If you want, you can ask me about it. But let me just wrap up for now, and before we go to questions, and say that what's the sort of conclusion or the point that I want to make is that, well, you know, randomness, probability, and uncertainty, they're everywhere around us, right? And some people might think, well, you know, I organize my life so well, and I plan everything so well that I don't have any randomness and uncertainty, right? But, well, you know, probably you can't get away with that, right? You're going to have to deal with other people. You're going to have to deal with a transit system or a traffic jam or a computer that doesn't work. You know, we're all going to have randomness that we have to deal with. So there's randomness out there. You can't avoid it. But what you can do is use what I call the probability perspective, or just a bit of an understanding of how randomness works or how we can kind of compute, not with a lot of mathematics, but just with a little bit of sort of common sense or taking the time to think about things. And it can help you to worry less about all these bad things that are actually much less likely than the headlines would have us believe. It can sometimes help you to make wiser decisions if you understand things better. It can help you to understand the world in other ways sometimes. And also, it can be useful. So first of all, there's a lot of sort of everyday uses that I tried to talk about. But then also, for scientific computation, it turns out, maybe surprisingly, that actually using randomness is key to a lot of modern, high-dimensional scientific computation. And if you want more, it was mentioned in my book, which, you know, doesn't have any equations, nothing to be scared of, but it develops a lot of these themes in more detail. Also, my website has some more information, too. And anyway, I'll just thank you again very much for having me here and for coming out. Thank you.
So a really stimulating lecture. Time now for our question and answer session. So for those of you who have a question, please raise your hand high, and Julie or Sue can find you. We'll ask that you stand and ask a short, succinct question so that we can take as many possible questions as we can tonight. So Sue, starting right up here on the aisle, we'll start on the right-hand side. Your question, sir.
Well, thank you, Dr. Rosenthal. That was a really fascinating lecture. If I say the name Marilyn Bus Savant, I'm sure you'll know what I'm getting at.
Sure.
The three-door or Monty Hall
yes.
problem.
Sure,
I don't consider myself particularly proficient at statistics, but I was able to work out the correct answer within an hour with a pencil and piece of paper. How is it possible that hundreds, if not thousands, of math and statistics profs could not get the answer? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's a good question. So first, to fill people in case you haven't heard of what's called the Monty Hall problem, was this problem just posed in an article, as he mentioned, and it sort of said, well, you know, what if there's a car behind one of three doors, and you pick, say, door number one, but then the host, Monty Hall, before allowing you to find out whether the car is behind door one, says, look, I'll open door three, and look, the car's not behind door three. Now do you want to switch from door one to door two, or do you want to stick with door one to give you the best chance of winning the car? And most people's initial reaction would be, if you haven't heard it before, would be that it's equally likely now that the car is behind door one and door two. But it's not hard to work out that, assuming Monty Hall actually knew where the car was, and assuming Monty Hall was always going to open some door that didn't have a car behind it, then the fact that he opened door three actually now makes it that there's a 2/3 chance that the car is behind door two, and only a 1/3 chance that it's behind your original door. So it's a sort of counterintuitive thing. It's not hard to work out once it's explained, but what is also amazing, which is as you were saying in your question, first of all, a lot of people get it wrong, and that isn't maybe so surprising, because I think a lot of things with probability people get wrong, but also people feel very strongly about this question. And when it was originally posed in the article, she received hundreds and eventually thousands of letters from people writing in saying she was wrong, including from a lot of math professors, right? And people who, you know, should have known better maybe. Now, but not only that, but in very strong terms, you know, like she said, well, you have a better chance of getting the car than the goat. Somebody wrote in and said, actually, you're the goat. And that was kind of typical. And I thought that was kind of strange. And then when I published my book, I mentioned it a bit, and I gave some sort of simple explanation of why it's true. And then I did some TV interviews, and in one of them, they asked me about it, and we did a little demonstration. The TV station got two angry emails from people saying that I was wrong, and how could a professor of statistics think this? And I felt just like Marilyn Vos Savant at that point. So it's an amazing thing. It's a problem that's sort of counterintuitive. It fascinates people, and it makes people very angry, too.
I have a bit of a follow-up question on game shows, particularly quiz shows. The program Deal or No Deal drives me crazy. It's the most useless quiz show I've ever seen on television. What can you tell us about the odds and randomness behind that game?
Right, so Deal or No Deal, probably most of you have seen it, right, where there's a bunch of briefcases and one of them has $1 million sticker in it, one of them has a one penny sticker in it, and a bunch of other ones. You get one and then you gradually get to open up the other ones and see what prizes have already been taken. And at various points you can either keep your briefcase with your prize or you can agree to take an offer from the bank, right? So now of course there's 26 briefcases, so the chance that you have the $1 million briefcase is simply 1 in 26, that's pretty simple. But then as briefcases get opened up, it does get sort of, in my mind, interesting. I guess I don't mind the show quite as much as you do, but because what's interesting is that you know, there'll be a certain number of prizes revealed, so there'll be a list of prizes that have not yet been revealed. And in this case, because the host doesn't know where the prize is, you're equally likely to have any one of the remaining numbers. So from a probability point of view, what I would do, and what actually I was interviewed in a newspaper once and did this as a test, and I did pretty well, actually, but anyway, was I would say, well, let's look at the average of all the unopened numbers. And that's what, on average, my briefcase has, because it's equally likely to be any one of them. And then what the bank is offering me, you know, pretty much I would say if the bank is offering me considerably more than that average, I might take it. If they're offering me considerably less than that average, then I might not take it. And one interesting thing about the game, and actually to me, it's more like the stock market than you might think at first, because if you say, no, I don't want to take that bank's offer, I'm going to open up some more briefcases, you're not necessarily saying, I think my briefcase has a lot of money. I'm saying, if I open up a few more briefcases, maybe the banker will offer me more money. And in that sense, it's like when you buy a stock. You're not really saying, I think this stock is worth a lot more than I paid for it. You're saying, in another month, I think somebody else is going to be willing to pay me more than I paid for it, right? So it's a question of you're sort of going not just with the probability of what you actually have, but with what somebody else is going to offer, too. So anyway, but it's an interesting game, I think.
Thank you. Question over here by Julie. No? Okay, question over here by Sue.
Two questions, and I'll let you choose which one you want to answer. First one's frivolous. The second one's quite serious. The frivolous question, what exactly does accurate 19 times out of 20 mean? The serious question is, what are the chances of the Maple Leafs winning the Stanley Cup in the next 10 years?
I think I'll answer the frivolous question first, actually. The Maple Leafs, I have, when I was in the media, I did get a fair number of calls from reporters about that. You know, what's the chance of the Thorby winning the playoffs and so on? And you can, if you make an assumption, like say they're 50-50 to win each remaining game, then you can figure out the chances they'll make the playoffs and so on. And basically, for the Maple Leafs, the chances are never very good, right? But anyway, to answer the 19 times out of 20, I mean, it's a quite interesting thing. So, you know, we've all heard these opinion polls that, you know, accurate within 3.1 percentage points, 19 times out of 20. And in the book, I go into a fair bit of detail about that. And it works out, you know, it's sort of, I guess you can think of an analogy. Suppose you flip a coin 1,000 times. On average, you'll get about 500 heads, right? We all know that. But you probably won't get exactly 500 heads. You might get 503 or 490 or 517. And you say, well, how close to 500 are you actually likely to be? And it turns out that you're quite likely to be within about 30 of 500 in that particular case. So you'll probably get within about 470 heads and about 530 heads. And that's a fact that's easy to work out. And then for opinion polls, it turns out it pretty much translates to the same thing, that if you sample 1,000 people, then you'll probably get fairly close to the true percentage of people who support a certain candidate, but you won't get it exactly right. And it's really the same kinds of probabilities that come together. And in fact, if you sample 1,000 people, then by the usual way of calculating it, you'll be within about 3.1 percentage points, which is about 31 coin flips out of 1,000 coin flips, right? You'll usually, about 95% of the time, be within about 3.1%. So when they say, oh, this is accurate to within 3.1 percentage points 19 times out of 20, that's what they're saying. They're saying it's like flipping 1,000 coins and getting that level of accuracy. And in fact, there's a pretty simple formula that if you take 96% and then, if you take 98% in this case and divide by the square root of the number of people sampled, like the square root of 1,000, that'll give you a good approximation to the margin of error. So if you want to impress your friends, then the next time you're reading the newspaper and they say, oh, there's a poll that says, you know, the liberals are down and it's accurate too, you say, wait, let me calculate that, and you can tell them the margin of error. There's no great mystery to it. So.
Okay, question over here.
Good evening. My question is more to do with statistical studies, and when you do, if you do a short one or a longer one, and you get, like you say, you get the, when you have large numbers, you get a truer response.
Right.
Now, how do you decide, like, which is the correct one, or how do you decide whether you've done it long enough or large enough, so to speak, and whether that would change what you've got, whether, if, you know, sometimes maybe it's not even possible to do it longer than what you can do because of, let's say, limited information or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so it's a good question. So medical studies and this issue of, you know, how many people do you study and then what conclusions can you draw? And in some sense, it's kind of similar to the polls in the sense that we can work out things like, well, if we've, you know, studied this many people and these are the results that we've got, we can say at what level of probability we're sure that the true answer is within a certain range. And in fact, with medical studies, often it's phrased in terms of what's called the p-value, you might have heard of, and often the p-value would be the probability that you might have observed such a result even if there was no true effect. So for example, maybe, you know, the drug lowered people's blood pressure, but there weren't that many people and it didn't lower it that much, and you have some model, and it tells you, well, maybe there's, you know, a 17% chance that their blood pressure would have just happened to lower and it didn't have anything to do with the pill. And there's a standard in medical research, and actually in a lot of research, which says that the p-value, this probability that, you know, could have happened just by chance, should be less than 5% or less than one chance out of 20. And so what it means, I mean, one way to think of it is, you know, when a medical study proves dot, 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 well, there could be as much as one chance in 20 that the result was just completely from luck, you know, and not really anything to do with what the pill did. And in particular, these p-values are sometimes published. So, you know, I always tell people, if you go to your doctor and the doctor says, hey, you know, medical study's proved, you have to take this pill, you say, well, that's great, doc, but what was the p-value of that study? What was the probability that the study actually didn't prove anything after all? Probably the doctor won't even know, right? Or even if they do, you say, well, there's some chance it didn't prove things. So now, of course, there's even more to it, because even aside from the p-value, the study might not have been set up correctly, or some other study might contradict it and so on. So there's actually a lot that one could say. But the short answer, which is already too late for a short answer, but is that... that you can compute, using the statistical model, you can compute the probability that it does prove what it claims to prove, and that's related to the p-value. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay, question at the back.
Could you tell us something about the history of random number generators, how they work? And I read some years ago that random number generators are not necessarily 100% random.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Would you like to comment?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, so random number generators, the idea is, you know, how do computers make randomness? Well, if you think about it, you know, usually, as I said before, we think randomness is kind of bad and we want to avoid it. But then if you actually want randomness, like you're doing Monte Carlo experiments or you're writing a computer game or anything else, you actually want your computer to be random. Well, it's not that easy to make a computer be random, right? So the most common thing is computers use what are called pseudo-random number generators, which are usually sort of fairly simple formulas involving usually multiplication and addition and then modular arithmetic in order to come up with a sequence of numbers which actually aren't random, but just which sort of bounce around in such an unpredictable way that for all intents and purposes, they seem to be random. And there's a whole history. I mean, people do a lot of research on how to make a good job of making the computer fake its randomness. And they usually work pretty well in practice, but not always so well. And it's one issue, certainly with, say, Monte Carlo stuff. You say, well, you know, you got this great simulation, but what random number generator were you using? And how certain are we that it's correct? And in some things, like in encryption algorithms, where security is very important, they use sometimes randomness on the computer to generate random keys and so on. And sometimes what they'll do is they want to be even more random than just a pseudo-random number generator. So they'll use physical things too, like the current temperature of the CPU or the speed at which the hard disk is spinning or that kind of thing, to try to make things more random. So it's a constant battle in a way, sometimes to avoid randomness, but sometimes to make things random too. And there's a whole history of that. So,
quick question about gambling. And I was following your talk on craps and casinos. And let me put you in the hot seat now that I know that you like watching Deal or No Deal.
Sorry.
So, okay, I give you a plane ticket to Las Vegas and $1,000 to spend. How would you use the money? On gambling.
Right. Well, I mean, the honest answer is I actually don't go to casinos very much. So, but on the other hand, there's sort of, the way I think of it, there's two classes of games at a casino. And one is sort of the games which don't have much strategy. You just sort of follow fixed rules. So like craps or like a roulette wheel. And actually, among those games, craps with the 49.29% chance is actually the closest to being 50-50 of all of the sort of standard games. So if I had to use sort of a fixed game, I'd probably play craps. But then some games have skill. So like a blackjack, for example, and famously people try to, you know, count cards and give themselves a bit of advantage at blackjack. Or a poker, obviously, there's a lot of skill and choice in it. So I think if I seriously wanted to make money at the casino, I would probably hone my skills at blackjack or at poker as best as I could and then try to make money that way, because that would be a case where I could hope that my skill and knowledge could actually make the odds in my favor. So.
Okay. Any last questions? One back here.
Hi, this is just a follow-up on the previous question about random number generators. I'm just wondering, like, as a statistician, what is your precise definition of randomness? Because if you at least hypothetically look at it from a deterministic point of view, that every event is probably influenced by other events, and I mean hypothetically you could predict everything. So is randomness actually governed by our ability to measure a system?
Okay. Yeah, so there's a few issues in there to do with, you know, what do we mean by randomness. Now one thing we could mean is that things just sort of you know, happen, as you say, without being influenced by other events and so on, and there's sort of true randomness. And, you know, if you believe in the Newtonian view of the world, you say, well, really, there's no true randomness because things actually follow physical laws. If you believe in the quantum mechanics, then you believe that at its most fundamental level, there's actually really true randomness that's part of nature, which is something that's very sort of hard to get your head around. But from a more practical statistical point of view, in, for example, computer algorithms and so on, then what we mean by randomness isn't so much whether in some, you know, a philosophical sense things are truly random, but whether from a statistical point of view they're unpredictable. Or from a statistical point of view, for example, the guy walking around the mountain range will not have any discernible patterns, but will follow things according to the probability. So there's sort of a practical use of randomness where we want it to pass certain statistical tests. And then there's a more philosophical thing of, well, can things be random at all? And, you know, if quantum mechanics says things are truly random, what does that even mean? So there's some issues there, too. So sort of a couple ways to think about it. But I'll leave it at that.
OK. And maybe we'll close on one note that you and I talked about earlier in the evening, and that was with regard to email spam. Everybody in this room here gets email spam. There must be some incredible dynamic behind that that says one in a trillion people are going to respond to an email that says they have some long-lost bank account on the other side of the world. You've done some hard thinking on this, so what is your analysis on spam?
Right. So yeah, so first of all, one of the things I think about with email spam is, of course, what we'd all like is for our computer to automatically figure out which emails are spam and which ones aren't, and to block the spam. And of course, computers are doing that more and more. And a lot of the algorithms that they use actually use probability. And they'll do things like analyze the frequency of certain words and see which words are more likely to appear in a spam email and which words are more likely to appear in an ordinary email, which they call ham email, right? So then, and for example, so things like the word madam turns out to have a high spam probability, or what's called the spamicity, because of all those dear, I didn't make that up, it's spamicity, because of things like dear sir or madam, right? Or for a while, the Nigerian scam was also, you know, if it says Nigeria or Republic, then it might be spam. So computers use those things, and they try to update a big database of all kinds of words that are more and less likely to be spam to compute an overall probability when a message comes in that it is spam. So that's quite an interesting area of again, you know, research or how to come up with good algorithms. But another part of your question was sort of, you know, what are the economics behind it? Because it's true that there's a very low response rate on most of these spam emails, as you might guess. It's one, you know, it's one person out of millions who's actually going to buy, you know, the Viagra that they're selling in the spam email, right? So then you say, well, how is it economically feasible for them to do this? Well, one answer, of course, is that it's so cheap to send out emails, and that's why spam is so widespread. Another thing, though, that is my understanding is that there's sort of two people trying to make money off of spam. One of the people who are actually wanting to send out spam to sell you their product. Another are the people who are offering as a service to send out spam for people who want you to send it out. And they're writing programs and providing computer servers to send it out. And they're charging the manufacturer, you know, if you pay us money, we'll send out your spam. And those second people are the ones who are definitely making money off of spam. And I think the reason spam continues to be such a problem is largely because of that second group. There's people who actually make money off of the business of how to send out spam. So anyway, some interesting issues there. And I do talk about that in the book, too. But
thank you. With that, I'd like to close and thank our guest speaker, Jeffrey Rosenthal, for coming once again.
To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.